You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
What I'd like to do, though, is not being the lecturer up here and just give you another jump on another way of looking at the same kinds of things we talked about, but maybe be the catalyst for discussion. There are times here when we've really gotten into the give and take, and I'd like to invite that. I'm more than happy that this pitch could be used as a means of doing that. Now, first let me explain what this pitch is. In the 9th Marine Regiment, where I just came from, I give this pitch to all the battalions when they first come in. I want to explain a little bit about the officer school out there, because it's necessary, I think, for you to understand some of this. Our officer school is pretty extensive, and there's a couple reasons why it can be. We're not encumbered by dependents out there. It's a good thing. I try to run the officer school in a series of different kinds of events. On Friday afternoons, we do the theory or the math exercise, which lasts a good whole afternoon and usually into the happy hour in the band and the cruise in Kingville. On Wednesday evenings, we do what we call battlefield skills. The lieutenants got on me and said, the theory and the math exercise are great, kind of the things that we've been doing in here, the sand tables and everything else, but we want some of the techniques too. So that's where I teach scouting and patrolling, where we teach takedown of a building, that sort of thing. We also have Warriors Night, where we bring people from outside to talk to the officers about certain things. We had Mike Wiley and General Van Riper talking about moving warfare. We had them on special operations, Mount, you know, with General Christmas and General Johnson, and those sorts of things. The officer school program is pretty involved, and we use that as a way of maybe teaching the concepts of maneuver warfare to a lot of different areas. I give about 95 to 98% of all the officers to the first. Now, there's a reason for all that, the reason why I'm telling you this. One of the things we're dealing with is commander's intent here. We've had a big discussion about that. My feeling, what I tell all lieutenants when the units first come in, is someday that lieutenant might find himself on top of a hill with his platoon, you know, that we are somewhere doing something for real, or maybe on an exercise and not for real, but as things normally happen, he can't talk to anybody, but he knows he's got to do something. Now, at that point in time, he's got to ask himself, what would Colonel Zinni expect me to do right now? And I want him to have a clue. So commander's intent begins when he first arrives in my regiment. I begin explaining to him how I think, how I feel things go down. This class is my idea, my conceptualization of the battlefield and fighting and what it's all about. I also tell him that when we're at officer school, he has a right to challenge anything I say. As a matter of fact, I wrote a letter to all my officers. It's the lead into the first math exercise that says, my solutions, my statements, my concepts should be under the most serious challenge. And they have to stand up and question and challenge it. Don't accept anything that I say. And they take me up on that. There's some officers in here that have been through that, Lieutenant Brown and a few others that were out there in the battalions that came through. And I'll tell you, they'll stick it to you in a heartbeat, because Mike Wiley's the world, everybody else, they little mavericks out of these guys, and they come out of there and they're gunning for you, you know. And I got to tell you the truth, and I'd be lying, they sent me back to Blackboard many times. I've had to change my slides, scratch my ideas, hope the next battalion didn't realize that some lieutenant taught me that myself, you know. But then you got to be that way. You got to accept and learn. Now, I'm not going to give you the pitch exactly the way I give it there. I'm going to give you the concepts and things and the statements I make, but then I'd like you to draw examples from experiences out there to bring them out to you. One unusual thing about out there I think worth talking about. I mentioned today that 15 battalions came under the 9th Marines' control while I was out there in 2 years through the DT program. I also had another 4 infantry battalions operational control under me in exercises for 10 days to a month. You know, so that's a total of 19 battalions, infantry. I've also had armored assault LAI for another 2, and I've had 2 different battalions artillery direct support. From every single infantry regiment in the Marine Corps, I've had battalions. So if you want to know a guy that can tell you what the Marine Corps is about, or the battalions, at least one perspective, if you want a judgment on Lejeune versus Pendleton versus K-Day, I can give it to you, you know? And if you want a comparison or what they're coming with or without, I think I can give it to you. The experiences are based on 10 major exercises or deployments, and a shit-pot full of observations and training and things that were done on Okinawa or short-term off of that. There were MUSOC, They were the regiment as part of the division. They were as part as an RLT as part of the brigade. You know, so it's a variety of experiences too. Combat concepts are my thoughts of 24 years experience about combat. And I got to tell you, the first thing that struck me as a regimental commander when I got there is I need to take the previous experience that I've had in Vietnam, in my course of time in the Marine Corps, in what I've read, and I've got to distill this and decide what I think, and at least have a starting point. Lay these concepts out, and then make sure it's dynamic. You're willing to change, you're willing to accept the criticism of somebody teaching you something. This little thing has changed probably 50 times in 2 years that I've given it. And I think it's important for a commander to come to grips with his own feelings and his own understandings and lay it out in front of his officers and staff NCOs. I need to get into the staff NCO education program we have and the NCO program, and this is part of it too. But the idea is that I've got to expose my thoughts. It's the beginning of understanding each other, familiarity, commander's intent. I've got to tell you another side of this thing before I launch into it. The chief of staff when I first got there was Colonel von Reicher. Now, I want to tell you, when I walked in and got him, I got some strict marching orders from the chief. The chief told me that it's not enough to talk about maneuver warfare. And you can have all the classes you want up there, Zinni, and all the little math exercises you want, and that doesn't impress me worth a shit, because everybody's doing that. He said, what our task is going to be in 3rd Marine Division is we are going to apply this. And we're going to learn the lessons of trying to put it into practice from the squad level to the division level. And we're going to make it work or find out why not. So that was my chart. And we'd get together every once in a while and talk about where we screwed up or where I screwed up, usually what we talked about. And the lessons learned and the trouble we were running into, the success. I got to tell you another thing. Inside the classroom, There's no one out there, Lieutenant Colonel below, that's not accepting this. I mean, there are a lot of people that understand it in varying degrees that don't understand it to a certain degree. They accept the maneuver warfare doctrine. They're happy about it. But I found that within the classroom, it all was good, it was accepted, it was fine, and I felt really warm and fuzzy when I go out to a third training, we do an exercise in business as usual. None of this manifested itself in an application in training, in day-to-day life, in the exercises that we did, the deployments, and a couple of real contingencies that we kind of almost got into out there, too. So, by God, I had to take General Van Riper, then Colonel Van Riper's tasking to heart and try to apply this. And I want to bring out some of the lessons learned. Now, let me make the first point here. The first slide I always lead off with in capital letters is this one. The commander in combat. Before I get into anything else, because, you see, we depersonalize what this is all about. We're process-oriented, it's come out here in the last couple of days. I think if I had to describe our system, what we would say, if, again, that Martian came down and visited the Marine Corps, is you built yourself a process. You built yourself a bunch of checklists and a system. And what you're telling me is personalities don't count, people don't count. Just take the guy and kind of put him through some rudimentary training, processing through the school, plug him in, and the system will take care of him. The staff will take care of him. The planning process will take care of him. Well, it doesn't work. It doesn't happen that way. The most important component of command is the commander. The commander has got to have a personality, he's got to have a style, he's got to have an innovative, fresh thought once in a while, he's got to drive things. You know, he can't just be another guy in the system, in the organization. And so I always spend the first part of this pitch talking about the commander. There are two people on that battlefield, either the commander or the leader who supports the commander. Now, my officer schools require everybody attends. The chaplain, the doctor, the motor T officer, the supply officer, everybody. And we only talk in officer school about war fighting. There's no such thing as, you know, we're going to cover how to read the less today or any of that other bullshit. Now, we talk about war fighting only. And it's important to not write yourself off because they're not the commander. I told some of you that I got a class on the chaplain in combat. It's a very important class. Matter of fact, the chaplain, the division psychiatrist, gave one of the best officers we had on handling combat stress and returning the guy to the front line and where the chaplain ought to be located during combat. And it was pretty valuable. It was very important. Generated maybe more discussion than any other officer school ever heard. And read about some of the battles of World War II and look at how many people we lost to battle fatigue. And you can see that's a tremendous brain. This guy has a lot to offer both of them if they're motivated properly and want to do that. Now, I tell my guys that what they've got to do is basically four things. One is understand the battlefield. Second, be able to sense the battlefield. Three, be able to take the battlefield and finally be able to fight the battle. It's this simple. This is what you as a commander or a leader who supports the commander has got to master. Now, how do you understand the battlefield? Well, part of it's what we're doing today. It's part of what the schools do here. It's trying to distill from our study, our readings, previous wars, from reality what the battlefield's all about. It's more to it than that. I mean, reading's great. I like reading. There's three things I know for sure that reading won't get you there totally on. You know, it's how to fight, you know, it's how to cook, and it's how to make love. And you can get some great ideas out of books, but still, you got to do some of this stuff once in a while to really get good at it, you know? And that's what some of my guys think can appreciate that. Now, we go to the field, all right, and we go on to an exercise. How closely do we simulate combat? In some areas, we do pretty well. In some areas, we simulate things very well. In some areas, we don't approximize combat, but we do something pretty close. In other words, we certainly create enough friction ourselves to have friction present. It isn't the same kind of friction, but there is a friction. You know, we almost get inside our own OODA loops and unravel ourselves. But, you know, it's a sense of understanding what the battlefield is, what friction is about. Things are screwed up. Every after action, every hot wash up, everybody's bitching about calm. Calm wasn't good enough. Calm is never good enough. I got a rule in my dream to shut down two-thirds of the next. My commos love that shit, see, because there's no pressure on it. You know? I don't like to see little sparks with arrows going up, sideways, down. Screw that shit. Give me at least one VHF, UHF, HF. That I'm happy. You know? Two-thirds of the nets are shut down. We randomly take the nets and close them down to see if we can operate with one-third of the nets. The last meth exercise that I went on, you know what the requirement of the meth was for radio nets? 412 nets. Can you imagine that? 412 nets, you know, emitting all in the same bridge square? I mean, it's no way. I don't want to turn shit on. And communication is not common. I'm going to talk about common. The other part of understanding the battlefield here, too, though, is sometimes we trick ourselves. We think we understand about the battlefield, and we don't. We take something in training that presents itself and assume it's reality. I had two tragic experiences out there, two helicopter crashes, one that cost me 30 Marines and another one that cost me 14 Marines, you know, out of two of my battalions. I was there for both of them. On one, I was in the zone when they were picked up. I spent the day with that company when that bird went down. On the second one, I was on the ship on the bridge when it went into the water. Now, let me tell you something. These were in the middle of an exercise. These are Marines that were caught up in a very realistic exercise. One of USOC exercise, one of force-on-force in Korea with everything. And it was in the middle of Team Spirit, the largest exercise we do, so we had everything. So, I mean, there were airplanes, tanks, cracks, so they were caught up, real villagers, and the troops were into it, real aggressors that are working against them. That particular company, for example, had just finished a masterful ambush. What we had done is we had laid my CP as bait, which I really love, but actually my command group out in the middle of this little grove of trees. We were convinced the bad guys would see us. The other guys had a little used sock outfit, the one that floats around out there, and we knew they'd do something against us. So we laid in an ambush with that company. We hid the troops around the paddy dikes, and we put the heavy machine guns in Hummers in the tree lines and some LAIs, LAVs. When the helicopters came in for the big assault raid on CP, they go, whack, they ran out. This company was euphoric. I mean, they were on a high. They were great. When that tragedy hit, when that one platoon was wiped out and 30 men died, that company was just devastated. That battalion was devastated. Now, for the first time, they experienced a real feeling that would happen in wars. We were playing cowboys and Indians, bang, bang. We were assessing casualties. People were being medevaced out with pretend wounds with moulage kits. These were real dead people that you had to dig out of a burning helicopter. And they experienced, for the first time, and hopefully the only time in peacetime of training, the real feeling of a loss and dead buddies and everything else. That's something you can't simulate. Now, my obligation to the battalion commanders was to get their head back in the game and force them to go right back into the exercise, which in both cases we did. And there were some questions about that. Some troops saying, should we continue on or should we get back into the helicopter? You know, obviously the leader's got to be the first ones in and you've got to show them. But that's an element of the battlefield, understanding it, that you can't ever simulate anywhere. Those troops will never forget that. Those of us who were in Vietnam, we lived that. Now let me tell you another part of understanding this battlefield that they want from me. I got to be honest with you. This is one I don't feel good about. They're always hitting me up for your combat experiences in Vietnam. I had two tours in Vietnam. One as an advisor to the Vietnamese Marine, one as a ranking company commander. They want to always tap you for what was it like. There's a temptation to take the experiences you had and draw too much out of it. And you got to be careful of that. We have, our memory does a trick on us. I remember things differently than they maybe really were. Maybe better than they were. Maybe I remember lessons that weren't really there. Maybe I remember doing things in a very orderly fashion that led to some results that weren't done in an orderly fashion that didn't quite lead to that result that I made up. So I got to constantly do a self-test, and I'm a little reluctant to tack the combat experience and explain it. But it's necessary. I try to bring in the guys like Phil Fight, John Ripley, General Van Riper, all the people that were out there, Mike Wiley, that did have combat experience. One of the best nights we had was on combat leadership. And that was the night when I had General Van Riper, I had Colonel Ripley, John Ripley, and I had Colonel Bill Fight. Highly decorated, great combat experience, very credible men, and I put them in front of the officers and it was go for it, question and answer. An interesting thing happened. They asked these guys a question, and the three guys answered it in a different way. This blew their vacuum tubes. And they couldn't understand how three guys with a six-pot full of Navy Cross, Silver Stars, all these things, great guys, senior officers, came to different conclusions on the same experiences. And they started asking me, which one do you agree with? I hate to say this, guys get in trouble. They called one the Prussian, who I won't name, one the politician, and one the surfer. And you can sort out who they were. Don't wax your board, General. You're out there. But the lieutenants feel from these people were interesting in their approaches to the same thing. Things like flak jackets and helmets. I'm an anti-flak jacket helmet guy. I don't believe in them. I hate them. I don't think you ever need them. You ought to sit down. For a lot of reasons. I'll talk about later. They serve no purpose, you know. For every one of the guys you say, they just saved my life. There's 87 guys running around that were so tired, pooped out, worn out, that they didn't see the bad guy, got caught in an ambush, you know, the troops were trained. And they don't serve that kind of purpose. It's counter to mobility and everything else. But we got, that was just one thing that generated a real heated discussion amongst those officers. And amongst the group, because there were some of them that said, you wear them all the time, mine was that my chin strap was always buckled. Bullshit. I've never seen a chin strap buckled in any Vietnam picture I've ever seen in my life, you know. But that's a little off the point. It's a little bit trying to understand what goes on in the back. Sensing the battlefield. What I tell my guys is, you know, whether we're, I first heard this term finger licking here that we're talking about. But whatever this is, which is probably the basic instincts you got to develop about the battlefield, about war, this is, you got to learn how to sense what's going on in the battlefield, and you got to prepare yourself for how to sense it. I'm going to give you a couple examples. The only guy I ever met in my life that had a natural feel for this shit was Ray Smith. He was my XO when I was battalion commander, Ray Colton. And Smith was uncanny. He used to piss me off because I had to work hard at trying to figure shit out that came naturally to him. The scariest thing that ever happened to me in the middle of the cast, we had two engineer breaching teams to breach the wire to go into the bunker complex. And we had talked about, you know, this little lieutenant who had a genius idea. He says, sir, I'm going to create out of high a third breaching team in case one goes wrong. And I thought it was a little unnecessary, but he did it. Smart kid. One did not go. You know, one of those little Bangalore suckers did not go boom. And I was stuck with one company breaching going in. One hung up. The other breaching team was back with red. And one boom went. The other one didn't go right away, and I was in the track, and I was about to squeeze the handset to say, send up the breaching team, and over this thing came Ray Smith and said, I know you want the breaching team. I dropped the handset, you know, and got a little scared, but he used to do this shit to me all the time. But what I also tell my guys is a number of battles take place out there. The real battle is with the company commander and the platoon commander sees. That's the real battle. As you start moving back to battalion and regiment and everything else, a different battle takes place. The battle that goes on inside my COC can be an entirely different fight than really taking place. If I don't have a means of truly sensing the reality of the battle, as close as I can get it, I'm going to be experiencing a different fight back in my CP. You know, back at it with my command group, no matter where it is. I'm going to talk a little bit about command and control later and how you set yourself up to sense the battlefield. Not how you set yourself up, how I set myself up, whether you want to use it or believe it or not. But it's a way I have to do it to sense reality as much as possible. Understanding how to, I used to say see the battlefield here, because I think that's a term the Army uses in one of their manuals. But I got rid of see. I like sense, because I want to get away from ever thinking that it's just physically using your eyes or physically using reconnaissance or intelligence collection anyway. There is a sixth sense involved here, an instinct that you develop, and there's a way that, I want to use one of Colonel Boyd's terms, that you synthesize all these things and you draw conclusions and they come together. And that total sensing is important. The next one is shaping the battlefield. Now, if you talk to most officers about how you shape the battlefield, they would say it's battlefield geometry, or come down to that. You know, they physically get down on their maps, and there's a lot of little geometry that goes onto these maps, and all kinds of control measures. Exhaustive 3 comes up and says, their kernel is the battlefield, in black and blue ink. You can't even read the goddamn grid lines anymore on these maps. Now, I never looked at the 3's map. I never even looked at the 3, which pisses me off. Without a talk, I don't look at it. I always look at the 2's map. It's the only thing I focus on visually, as far as sensing the battlefield. Never the 3's map. I'm not interested in the 3. That's the way you'd like the world to be. That's not the way the world is. Some people think they shape the battlefield by a plan. A plan gets you started. You need a plan to kind of get the line of departure, to get to the starting gate through it. But after that, the plan's not worth much. It's just something to frag off of, you know, to be the basis of everything that got you there. I got a little phrase I tell all my guys, don't fall in love with your plan. And I constantly have to screw it, because the little suckers behind my back will produce the 8-pound top order. And so the first thing you got to do when you get to the field is change everything. As soon as they come in and they unroll the overlays and do all this shit, I change everything. My proudest moment as a regimental commander was on a tremendous rainy night. You know, when it was probably the most miserable night of my life, on a hill in Korea, stuck in the back of a Humvee, and the watch officer, this little captain, my S3 out, was sitting there, and it was time to issue a frag, and I told him what we were going to do, and he pumped out a quick yellow canary, and he took his big gigantic crayon, and he ripped out an overlay in about a nanosecond, which just basically was your basic fundamental nothing overlay. And he looked at that and he said, you know, Colonel, I used to pride myself on my overlays until I started working for you. And he said, I never would put any effort into these things anymore now, because I know what you're doing. I said, yeah, you're right, I understand. Matter of fact, you don't need that thing. Get rid of it. So it's important not to get hung up on all that. And of course, the key one is the actual execution and fighting of the battle day to day, minute to minute. Now, I want to take you back a little bit. I want to start somewhere. Back with Lieutenant Cheney. Lieutenant Cheney reported to this fine institution in 1965. A dirt ball straight off the streets of Philadelphia, okay? My father was a corporal in World War I, third grade education. My brother was a sergeant in Korea. I never knew another officer in my entire life, you know. I joined the Marine Corps by accident, went through PLC program, got through, got commissioned. The MOI at Villanova was shocked to even see me, didn't know I existed. People that, like Bathurst, who was one of the platoon sergeants down there, would have been surprised to find out they actually put bars on. I showed up here at basic school. Nothing was happening in the world. Nice set of dress blues, good paycheck. I was happy. Mary Washington was south. Bush, Neal, and I go up north to Washington, D.C. Life was good. Somewhere shortly after he got here, this little bastard decided to go into Vietnam with the Marine Brigade, and General Van Riper was down in Santo Domingo doing some shit. So we all got told, as these basic school instructors, well, you suckers are all going to die. We're at war now, you know? It became time to pay attention. And I figured, Vinny, I was going to be an infantry recruit. There was no one-third, one-third kit, you know, because I was at the bottom of the pit, and I was going to be an infantry kit. That's what they threatened me with, and they were going to fulfill that prophecy, and I was going to be an infantry kit. So now I decided it's time for me, if I'm smart, I long talked with myself in a third wing over top deck. You might go somewhere and actually get shot at me. It's a good idea if you figure some of this shit out. And I said, now I looked around at these guys, the pictures on the wall, they're going to tell me what to do. Lo and behold, that week, I was going to be queen for a day. I was going to be the squad leader on BO3, whatever, squad on the golf course out here, you know? That beautiful rolling piece that cuts grass and everything, range five or whatever it is. And I said, pay attention, because this is the way you're in. When I got out there with my little squad, they took me up to this area and had a little red sign. Yellow stenciling, red sign said, assembly area. Nice little grove of trees back there. And they explained to me the characteristics. This sucker is out of direct fire, observation of the enemy, you know. This is where he's trying to get your shit together. This is the order. Get your ammo, all your shit. Make sure you keep busy. But the little guy in his skunk hat will kill you if you don't. And you get here to issue your order and prepare to go into the attack. I had read that you better conduct a reconnaissance. So I go up to the guy in his skunk hat. Excuse me. I'd like to go forward to the line of departure and conduct my reconnaissance. Hey, good, Vinny. Another check mark, 5 points for Vinny. And I crawl up to the line of departure. Nice little berm that they had cut there. Crawled up, peeked over. There, out there, were all the things I expected to see. Wrote my little notes, got back, issued my order. Little sign up there that said, LD. The big argument here in those days is whether that should be L-O-D or L-D. We're in the heady shit. I wanted to calm that one. It was over my head. I came back to the assembly area, got my shit together, got my squad, moved up. Right behind the line of departure's little sign that said, attack position. I said, I don't have to occupy this. I know that. But it is the last covered and concealed position. Just in case somebody's got to take a dump before we go. I got it. I got to cross this thing to deploy. Regardless of what Cole says, you always pick a wedge. They can't screw with you if you're in a wedge. You know? Because you know, unknown, all-around security, unknown enemy situation. I mean, who's going to argue with the wedge? It isn't echelon right shit, echelon left. You already control. Nobody understands it. 1791 drill manual. I don't want to touch that one. We go over the line of departure now. And we're in the open. And the little target's up on the hill. And as we're moving down, the demo kits go. Boom, boom, boom. Aha, incoming, you know. Move through incoming. We go charging through incoming. Then, that, you know, what about a jam. A little simulator out there. Aha, incoming mixed with direct fire. Down, boom. Now, team one, prepare to rush, rush. Team two, prepare to rush, rush. Team three, and we do this up to the final coordination line. Another heady discussion. Final CL or SCL. Big discussion about all that. But, convenient. They told me that 75 to 150 meters from the objective, there would be a final coordination line. Figured in shit, it was there. Another berm on a golf course. And I got my guys up online. Make sure everybody's got a fresh magazine. All this. Now, we got this far by team rushes and crawling. But that ain't good enough for these guys. They know it's time to stand up. But this made perfect sense to me. So we all stood up. My job was to keep them all line. And another heady discussion, pointy method or hip. I'm one of those guys who say, this is type order, street spirit, hip or pointy method, whatever you want. We assault over the hill, and then we pursue by fire, and the gunny comes up, we get our chow, it's all done. They evaluated it as great. I'm ready for Vietnam. First firefight in Vietnam, I was in the vegetation this thick. And so fast it goes, bang! I can see one of my Marines here, one of my Marines there, nobody else. Where the hell's the lone pine tree, the assembly area, the little red sign, and ain't there? Five little pits. It kind of pits about a couple other things, too. No one told me about 20-meter contour lines over there. We were doing 20 feet over here. But I got, when I got back, I got to somebody in authority, some captain, and I said, what the hell's the story? You don't understand, Lieutenant. At basic school, we just teach you the basics. You have to have a foundation. That was just the foundation. Those are the basics. You have to go through that first. And well, I don't mind that, but why do I have to do my graduate work in Vietnam? I mean, this should be something that kind of gets me into jungle fighting, you know, in the real way. 24 years later, I'm still looking for the final coordination line, the line of departure, the phases of the offense, and all that other shit. It ain't there. You see, the problem is, what we got to do is look at reality, distill it down to a theory about war, and then learn how to apply it. You know, in here is going to be the doctrine, all the stuff we're trying to write. Here's the training and the application. You know, now I'm in here, which is great. This is easy, guys. Being back here is easy. Down here is hard. You know, I was one of these guys who taught here and at Command and Staff College. I got 10 and a half years at Quantico being part of the problem. And we put out shit that doesn't work down here. You know, it doesn't work. You want to hear the shit that my lieutenants tell me. I'm out here and I'm watching the Susan. I said, "What the hell are you doing, Lieutenant?" "Sir, this is the Australian teal that I was caught to take." The Australian teal? That sounds like some sort of strip show with kids, you know? Yeah, no, my guy told me, Steve, it's so focused in on this little shit. We can't even give, I want to back up the first sergeant here. We can't give a challenging password anymore. We had a good system for a challenging password. Halt, who goes there? Sergeant Finney with a friendly patrol. Fancy to be recognized. You are Sergeant Finney or you're not. You know, boss, hey, pass, you know. It was simple. Now, you're all James Bond, you know. The moon is blue, you know. How are you? Up the techniques now. You know, we could get the theory right, even the techniques are screwed up. And this is what my guys get here come out here trying to deal with. That's why we have battlefield skills on Wednesday night. You've got to watch everything they learn in Quantico out before you can start on this stuff. You know, I read something pretty interesting, and I think it was Montgomery, it's either Montgomery or General Hackett that said, the common phrase heard amongst officers after World War I in the British Army was, thank God the war's over, we get back to real soldiers. Now that reminded me of the Marine Corps. Thank God the war is over, we get back to real soldiers, the way we do it at Quantico, you know. It's not reality. It doesn't reflect reality. I drew up a little chart here of the difference between what I saw in practice and what I learned and what I think reality is. This place taught me, and all the exercise I was ever on, the battlefield is linear. We have lines all over the place. In practice, I would believe, if I were at marching, that war is linear. You know, we have coordinated fire lines, fire support coordination lines, you know. We have boundaries that are lines. Mike Wadley said we're in boxes all the time. That's right. You know, and we would believe that. My humble experience in Vietnam is a non-linear battlefield. The VC did everything in depth. If you had to characterize the VC by a formation, you'd probably get guys that always said, we're always getting caught in horseshoe ambushes. See, they looked at things in some kind of depth to deliver fire from two sides. And then the little bastard would connect these suckers like this. You'd run into a bunker complex on the reverse slope in the middle of the jungle that was a series of these kinds of things. So when you went to hit, you got nailed. You went to envelop it, like they taught me at the basic school, you got trick screwed again. You know, you went to do a masterful turning movement and come in, after got you again. I mean, you couldn't get this little guy. You couldn't get your hands around him. He didn't offer me all that flank shit and everything else, and I couldn't take him on frontally. This guy had steps. He had too many sides. He had too many facets to his formation. We were slick. We're in boxes and lines all the time. That doesn't work. This works. I was always taught frontal and flanking, basically. You take them on head-on, or conveniently, he'll have an unanchored flank that just dangles off the side of the hill. I got to be tuned for a day a second time. I got to envelop at range 5. The thing that scared the shit out of me is the hill was huge, and in those days, when men were men, we threw a Willie Peter grenade as a signal that the seats were shifted to face the fire. None of this smoke came. And I got out with that Willie Peter grenade, and I looked up that hill. After the guys in my squad were like this. And And the guy, the skipper, who was the guy who ran squad tactics, this big guy from the South, you know, one of those guys who was 87 and loads of tobacco here, said, Cindy, you an Alice arm? This would be the greatest role in my life, man. To haul that sucker up there. But the envelopment was the same. I mean, conveniently, all the targets were facing that way at the top, and they're like, this is great. You know, all the enemy will give us a front. They don't. Infiltration and penetration is the way you gotta go. We beat that to death. I know we've talked about that a lot. In practice, we seize terrain. We do what I call process terrain. We process ridge lines. We process high ground. We go from one piece of high ground to another piece. I was an instructor command staff college. We gave grade requirements there. Some of you were students at that time. Now you run the institution. They're better than everybody else. But we would say, give us a concept, you know, along with the overlay and everything else. I get these things back, they were great. The symbology was perfect. Everything was indented correctly. All the words were there. But it didn't say anything. They processed terrain. Objective one, objective two, objective outflow, objective problem, intermediate objective, because it's a little smaller piece of high ground, there's a bump between this ridge line and that ridge line. So it is a goddamn intermediate objective, you know? We process this terrain all the time. We overfocus on terrain all the time. As I said today, in the 9th Marine Regiment 2 years, I never ever designated a terrain objective. There was nothing that ever had RLT objective one or objective outline. Never. I never ever designated terrain objective. It misfocuses. It's needless. You don't need it. Terrain's overrated. When I say key terrain, first thing comes to mind is high ground. I contend high ground is not key terrain. Low ground is key terrain. The only time you occupy high ground is to control low ground. Really, a low ground, the avenues of approach, the kinds of places you move through are what's important. Everything else really gears you to that. You know, it's what gives you the freedom to move, and usually it's down there. Some interesting thoughts. I got a class on terrain and everything else and on movement. Interesting to study the VC and how they moved and why we couldn't find it. Because I read a few books written by some people, and I talked to some VCNVA prisoners when I was a stupid-ass lieutenant captain to figure out, why can't we ever find these little suckers? And he told me why, a couple of them. You know, it's the way they move. Ingenious, not the way we think about moving. I think really, instead of seizing terrain, you gotta look at how that enemy's deployed, where he is, where the force is, how he's disposed. And you gotta develop that disposition. That is gonna be what you're gonna do to unravel him rather than seize terrain. I was taught about deliberate attacks. I just described one. You know, the line of departure, the final coordination line, everything else. It's a series of meeting engagements most of the times out there. The guy never conveniently plops himself on top of the hill with one pine tree waiting for me to attack him. He just bumps into me and hits me when I'm not expecting him from the wrong direction. All the time he does that. He doesn't cooperate. He isn't part of school's demonstration troops like I learned when I was a lieutenant. SDT used to be the forerunner of the old EI company or support command, whatever the hell you call it now. Those guys play the game right. Bad guys don't. I learned about a deliberate defense. Once you stop, you change everything. On the military crest of a hill, you set in a defense. If you were in a zone, forget that. Now you're in a sector of the defense. You're not in a zone of attack anymore. Just because you stop. You know, now we have FPLs, PDFs, you know, vinyl protective fires. We're going to put out tactical supplementary protective wire. We're going to do all this shit, do all that. You know, we're going to put this tremendous defense in. The Maginot Line going in overnight. Never, ever in my life did I do that. I have always in my life put in a hasty defense. I stopped for a short period of time and had to get a hasty defense. I didn't change the names of things. I didn't have time to go through this tremendous preparation. You know, it just wasn't there. I'll tell you what, I used to look and sit on the front end of this thing and say, why am I here instead of there? Before somebody, and I read Mike Wiley's article in the Gazette on the reverse slope defense and found out, I'd be smarter if I was back there instead of up front here. You know, and that's where we're going to have to look at putting in these defenses. This is planning-oriented. This is execution-oriented. The way we talk about and practice it is process-oriented. The process is the end unto itself. We beat that to the death. This one's personality-oriented.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.